The following podcast is a glimpse into the life of Ecclesia Houston. We pray it is a blessing as you seek to follow Jesus, the liberating King, and live in his kingdom here on earth as it is in heaven.
So for about the last 6 or 8 months, I have just gone down this weird, strange YouTube rabbit hole, and I have been watching this guy on YouTube who says that his channel is about psychology. And he's a psychologist. But it is not at all about psychology. It is about dating. And so I have two daughters, one that's 20 and one that's 17. They, like many of you, are in sort of the dating pool. And I wanted to know, what is it like? What's the conversation right now around dating in our world? Because every now and then, one of you will come to me or send me an email and you'll be in a new relationship or trying to get a new relationship and you will ask me about my thoughts about dating. And that's the point that I want to remind you, that I have not been on a date with a new person in 28 years. I have no clue. Like, some things I'm assuming are the same. And some things are really different. I know that apparently somewhere there are apps about this. Like, I don't know any of that. Like, if I had an app, a dating app on my phone, that would be a problem. So I started listening to this guy about talking about dating. And it is the weirdest, strangest, most wrong advice I have ever heard. Because it's not about love or connection, loyalty, faithfulness. It's what I would call a part of like bro culture. And it's primarily about how to sustain dominance and control over your partner. He has topics like why women never apologize, how women secretly make men angry. Like on and on and on. I mean, like, it is the worst advice in the world. But as I watched more and more of them, I realized that if you actually listen to people talk, it's a great life hack. If you let people talk long enough, they will actually tell you what they mean. And if you listen closely enough, something happened at some point in this dude's life where he was hurt badly. And he's also really short, which I think has part to do with it. And I realized, like, he's just setting up for himself and hopefully for others sort of the rules that he wants to date by and to have a relationship by. And what happens whenever anyone does that is that the Psalms were actually right when they said, like, deep calls to deep, which means basically whatever it is you are, like, you just go out in the world and keep being that thing and you will attract other people who are that thing. Like, deep calls to deep. And so what happens is he's had this slew of bad relationships or had something really painful happen to him. And so he's chosen that these are the rules to dating, to keep himself protected and to keep his feelings from being hurt and to keep control and power. And so he draws to himself other people for whom those are the same rules. And one of the realities of life is that the rules actually determine the outcome. Very few things are objective. The rules determine the outcomes. I also know this because my daughters grew up playing Uno. And when I was a kid, I played Uno with my family, and you know the object of the game is to run out of cards before everybody else, and you play one card at a time. But a couple of years ago, we sat down as a family one night to play Uno, and the girls looked at each other and said, "Are we stacking?" And I thought, what in the world is stacking? Because apparently, if you have a bunch of the same kind of card, like a draw two and a draw four, and they're all the same, like, you can play those all at the same time. And my girls want to do this because they hate their parents. And they want us to draw 18 cards all at the same time. And those are not the rules to Uno. To the extent that 3 weeks ago, the people at UNO released a press statement saying, those are not the rules to UNO. And maybe some of you are like me, and you are also NBA fans. And if you watch the NBA, what you have noticed over the last 30 or so years is that scoring has gone through the roof. Because I'm old enough to remember when a basketball game might end and the score would be 92-89. And now when a basketball game is over, the score is 4,053-12. Like it's something crazy like that. And there's a reason. And the reason is Michael Jordan retired. And so the NBA, as much as we like it, much as people played it and enjoy basketball, the NBA is a business. And they were concerned that without Michael Jordan, people were going to stop watching. And so in order to keep people watching, they wanted to increase scoring. So they made a rule change in 1999 about what's called the hand check. And the hand check was simply this, like a defending player could use a hand, sometimes two hands or an elbow to guide or push an offensive player to a certain spot or from away from a certain spot on the basketball court. And add to that what's called the restrictive area, which is this little semicircle under the basket. It's 4 feet, and you cannot breathe on a basketball player in the restrictive area. And so all defensive players can do now when you watch an NBA game is kind of stand there like this. Like that's all that they can do. And so scoring has gone through the roof, and contemporary basketball fans think that they are watching the greatest generation of basketball players ever. And you are not. Do you know when the greatest generation of basketball players was? Whenever you were in high school. Whenever you were in high school, that was like the greatest, because that's the last time that the players in the NBA were older than you. Like, that's why you think that. And now they're just a bunch of kids. But the outcome of UNO or relationships, basketball, the outcome of everything is predicated not on the object, but the rules. And so if you've been around Ecclesia for the last 4 weeks, you know that we have been in this series on the parables from the Gospel of Matthew. And all the parables in Matthew are pointing to one thing. They are illustrations, they are pictures of the kingdom of God. And so Jesus keeps saying over and over again as he begins these parables, the kingdom of God is like, or the kingdom of heaven is like. And it's trying to give us a picture of what it looks like when God's rule and reign exist. And so the parables want you to know a couple of things in order to understand them. The first is that everybody has a kingdom. You have a kingdom. It could be as small as your purse, or it could be a room in your house, or your car, or your company, your department. There is a place in the world where what you want done is done the way that you want it done. That is your kingdom. You are in charge there. Everyone has a kingdom. You already know how kingdoms work. And the second thing is that God has a kingdom. And when you walk out of these doors later today, you will go out into our world, and that will not be God's kingdom. But God's kingdom is everywhere that God's rule and reign is done, wherever it is performed. Which means right now, today, you can live inside of God's kingdom. That God's kingdom is available to you right now. If you want it. And so the parable that we're going to look at today kind of works on two levels. And one level, it's going to tell us about what the kingdom looks like, what the kingdom is. But there's something underneath it that once you see it and once you explore it, is so much more profound about what the kingdom is actually like. And so if you're here and you've come to believe, or maybe somebody told you that to live as a child, a servant of God, is gonna restrict your freedom, that's gonna curtail your life, that you're gonna have fewer choices rather than more, that it's gonna be worse rather than better. Well, understanding this parable might reshape how you think about what God is doing in the world. So, in Matthew 18, Jesus starts telling his parable like this. He says, I want you to understand the kingdom of heaven. Think about, if you want to understand the kingdom of heaven, think about a king who wanted to settle accounts with his servants. Just as the king began to get his accounts in order, his assistants called his attention to a slave who owed a huge sum to him, what a laborer might make in 500 lifetimes. Okay, so the best way to understand this out the gate is that there's this king and he's got all of this land. And so it's not just like a farm or a ranch. It's a lot of land. So think of something maybe the size of Houston. And if it was really large, maybe the size of Ohio. And you've got all of these people, these slaves, these farmers, these ranchers who work that land. And for the honor of living and working on that land, they pay tribute or they pay taxes back to the king, the big land owner, because they all live on his land. They work it for him and then they pay it back. It is a huge space of land and people working on it. And they go and they start doing the math and they find out that one of these people, one of these slaves who lives on the land, he owes 500 lifetimes worth to the king. And maybe the way that the king got the land in the ancient world is that there was a war and he won, or his group won, they conquered, and now all of the people who lived there before serve the king. And Jesus continues the story. He says, the slave, maybe an embezzler, had no way to make restitution. So the king ordered that he, his wife, their children, and everything the family owned be sold on the auction block. The proceeds from the slave sale would go toward paying back the king. So, Jesus tells us there's a servant who owns all of this money, 500 lifetimes. And so just like Pastor Chris talked about last week, oftentimes what happens in parables is that Jesus makes an extreme argument, 500 lifetimes, and that's just a lot of money that you're not gonna be able to pay back. And maybe the way that he got this money, because how else would a slave get it, is that he was close to the king or he worked in the accounting department. And slowly over time, he began to grift and take a little bit off the top. There's a church here in North Houston that I've known and loved for about 20 or 25 years. And I've done a lot of different work with them over the years. And about 15 years ago, they realized that they were missing $400,000. And what had happened was there was an executive on their staff who got a check that the bank had cashed, and he picked up the check and he called the bank and he says, hey, you guys have made a mistake. We have a two signature system here and you cash this check with only one signature on it. You can't cash checks with only one signature on it. And the bank said, no, you have a two signature system. We only need one signature to cash a check. And it just happened to be right at the time where he and his family were in pretty tough financial system, a bad state. And so as a signator on the checking account, He wrote himself a check, a small check. And it started the same way all of those things start. I'll just take a little bit and I'll pay it back. You know, I really earned this. They should probably give me a raise anyway. And the checks got larger and larger. And it wasn't long after that, his wife was cruising into the church parking lot in a brand new Mercedes. And the family was going on very extravagant trips all around the world. People at the church started coming to him, going like, "We know you don't make that much money. Help, give us some of your financial tips, because you are killing it." And they figured, you don't earn that much. You must just manage it better than the rest of us do. More than he could pay back. It starts very little. And so at the beginning of this parable, we find something that hardly ever happens in Scripture, where the king is actually a victim. That he's the one that has been mistreated. It's not simply that it's owed to him like a tax or tribute. It was his, and somebody took it. Jesus goes on. He says, upon hearing this judgment, the slave fell prostrated. The slave fell down, prostrated himself before the king, and begged for mercy. "Have mercy on me, and I will somehow pay you everything." The king was moved by the pathos of the situation. So indeed, he took pity on the servant, told him to stand up, and then forgave the debt. Now, this is a spot in the parable where Jesus' Jewish audience really perked up. And you need to remember a couple of things. The Gospel of Matthew is primarily written to a Jewish audience, and this parable is only found in the Gospel of Matthew. And the reason that they would have perked up their ears is because kings don't forgive. There's no reason to. There's no plus in it. There's no upside. He can't be overruled. There's nothing that anyone can give him. All the advantage flows toward the king. So just let me ask you, have any of you ever had someone who owed them a lot of money? Like besides your children, people who owed you a lot of money? And you knew that they could never, never pay it back. Well, if that were to happen, there's a whole range of options available to you that would be good and generous and other people would say was kind. You could say, you know, just get it back to me whenever you can. Take your time. You could say, pay me back half. You could say, all right, well, just come over to my house and do some work. What skills do you have? There are a whole lot of options that the rest of us would look and go, man, he is a really good person. Did you see what they did? But this king doesn't do that. This king forgives it all. But as wonderful as that is, what's more powerful is the reason that he forgives it all. He doesn't say, I know that you'll never repay this. I know you'll never be in a position to repay this. Matthew tells us that Jesus says that out of pity. It's this Greek word that's also translated compassion. That out of compassion, he forgives the debt. And compassion is a virtue. And this king comes to a point where he has a choice between a virtue or a value, and he chooses virtue over value. And it's at this point in the story that we begin to see the very beginnings of a new reality, that Jesus is living by a different set of rules. Because value says, this is what you owe me. This is what I'm entitled to. Don't you remember all the things that I've done for you? Like, you're gonna get some of that back. Value says, this is what the market says I should get. This is the value you bring to the market. And Jesus is saying, whenever it is clear to you that you have an option, that you have a choice between people and profits, you always choose people. That is a different set of rules. You have a choice in all of these little actions of whether you want to live a people-centered life or a market-centered life. And that would be enough for a parable. Jesus could stop right there, but he doesn't. Listen to what he says next. But the slave went out and found a friend, another slave, who owed him about 100 days' wages. Pay me back that money, shouted the slave, throttling his friend and shaking him with threats and violence. The slave's friend fell down prostrate and begged for mercy. Have mercy on me, and I will somehow pay you everything. But the first slave cackled and was hard-hearted and refused to hear his friend's plea. He found a magistrate and had his friend thrown into prison, where, he said, you will sit until you can pay me back. The other servants saw what was going on. They were upset, so they went to the king and told him everything that had happened. Now, if you heard that story and your first thought was, how ungrateful. Like, doesn't he know that everything that he has been forgiven? How can he not see what's going on here? And I want to submit to you that you would say that because you just read this parable. Because for me, this slave who goes out, that is the most natural thing in the world. I have been given by God incredible opportunity to spend time with Christians all over the country at different gatherings and conferences, which means that I have to fly to get to most of them, which means I have to buy a ticket on an airline. And because I am a credit card points hoarder, I want to pay and be reimbursed. And some of these organizations are terribly slow at reimbursement. And I think, you don't understand. I have to pay American Express back. So you need to pay me so I can pay American Express back. And if you've never been around me when I am upset, I am never more upset than when somebody owes me money. And it's also really easy to understand if you're the kind of person who's easily embarrassed. Because I can imagine swirling around in the back of this slave's mind this idea that I just got through having to beg, falling on my face, and I would have been able to pay the king back something if all of the people who owed me had paid me. That the real problem here is other people. And if they had paid me back, then I would not be embarrassed and have to go to the king. And that was so dehumanizing and embarrassing, that will never happen to me again. And so much of our behavior that is hurtful and harmful that is crushing to other people, that is ungenerous. So much of our behavior is rooted in the idea that something happened to us one time and that's never gonna happen again. I'm never gonna be embarrassed like that again. I'm never gonna be hurt like that again. So I'm gonna start a YouTube channel about dating. I think it's the most natural thing in the world. My life would be better if everybody else in my life got their life together. And Jesus continues. He says, the king summoned the slave, the one who owed so much money, the one whose debt the king had forgiven. The king was livid. You slovenly scum, he said, seething with anger. You begged me to forgive your debt, and I did. What would be the faithful response to such latitude and generosity? Surely, you should have shown the same charity to a friend who was in your debt. Now, this is an interesting question. What would be a faithful response? What would be your response? Because I know what we think our response would be. And I think I know what we would hope our response would be. I definitely know what the church answer to this question is because we just read the passage. But every day, you and I live lives of great privilege. We have been given so much, and we have been forgiven so much, and we don't pay it forward. Some of us were born on third base and think we hit a triple. Others of us were born into families who were able to give us the best of everything, or if not the best, the quality of everything. That we had every advantage, every leg up, that our parents or our friends or friends of our parents were connected in certain ways, that we had great education, we had great opportunity. Some of us have enormous physical gifts that we have been able to leverage to a successful career, and others incredible intellectual gifts that we have been able to leverage. And when we look around the world and we see people that we think aren't doing as well as we are doing or as well as we think they ought to be doing, what do we say? Get your act together. Pull yourself up. Work hard like I worked hard. As a matter of fact, about 8 years ago, there was an article in The Atlantic. And what they discovered, what researchers discovered, is if you sit down with the average person, especially the average successful person, and ask them why they were successful, they will tell you, we will tell you about how hard we worked, how hard we studied, the sacrifices that we made to put us over the top. But when you sit down with those same people and ask them to give a narrative of their life about how they succeeded, they go, oh yeah, there was this person who helped me out, who gave me a chance, who gave me the promotion. They were a friend of my mom or my dad, or we knew them from the club or from church. And people begin to realize when they narrate, when we narrate our story, that so much of our lives were just given to us. What would your response be? In a world like ours, where so many of us have so much more, have been given so much more, what would your response be? This is a new set of rules, a new way to be. And then Jesus continues with the story. He says, the king turned over the unmerciful slave to his brigade of torturers. And they had their way with him until he should pay his whole debt. And that is what my Father in heaven will do to you unless you forgive each of your brothers and each of your sisters from the very cockles of your heart. Which is a very beautiful passage, and I have no idea what cockles are. But I'm just saying it's deep, it's gotta be deep, right? Now, this parable is what it is about. Like, it is about forgiveness, yes. And on the top layer, Jesus wants you to know that this king is capable of being moved by compassion to the point of forgiveness. But it's also a pretty sticky ending. And throughout the history of biblical interpretation, people have argued about who is what in this parable. Who is God? Who do the slaves represent? Who's the second slave represent? What about the torturers? All of this. Because if this is a parable about forgiving, then you have to explain this end. Because is God forgiving if he is the king? Because he forgives at first and then he hands this guy over to the torturers. Is God forgiving, or is God just forgiving to a point? And I understand why we have those questions. But there may be something else going on here. This first slave wants to live in a world where if you owe me something and you can't pay it back, I'll put you in jail because those are the rules of this world. And at the end of this story, the king says, if you want to live by those rules, I will let you. If you want to live by the rules of retribution and what's owed to you, of receiving but not extending, you can. It's one of the frustrating aspects of who God is for people both inside the church and outside the church is that God will not force or coerce you to do anything. That you actually do make choices. And so if you want to live a relational life where it's all about control and domination and exchange, you will find other people who are interested in those rules. And if you want to be the kind of parent who tells their kids, do as I say, not as I do, because I said so, like, they will let you do that. If you want to have a politics that is about grievance and vengeance and power and control and domination, you can have that. Guess what? You get to choose. And so when this slave is given over to torturers, it's because those are the rules that he chooses. And you can live whatever kind of life you want to live outside of God's kingdom. But Jesus says it's torture. There is no love. There is no grace. There is no compassion. There is no faithfulness. There is no companionship. There is no kindness. But you get to choose the rules. And underlying all of this parable is this simple idea that Jesus is trying to reveal to us a different, an alternative way to be human. And the invitation is that you can choose to live inside that kingdom, an alternative way to be human if you want to. And what you will find there is a king who is full of love and grace and looks on your situation, whether you are the victim of it or the perpetrator of it, who looks on your situation with compassion. So, Ecclesia, this is what I want you to know. That today and tomorrow, you get to choose the rules you want to live by. And Jesus wants you to know, the rules determine the outcome.
Thank you for listening to our podcast. If you would like more information, please visit our website at www.ecclesiahouston.org.